You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
What do you know?
Never gonna know, never, never gonna know.
What do you know?
Thank you again, dear listener, for downloading yet another Dear Science podcast, the semi-weekly version of my column, Dear Science and the Stranger. You can read it. It trades off now. I'm being really diligent. You guys should give me, like, cookies or something, or send me nice emails. I really appreciate your nasty emails when I don't do it. It makes me feel loved. But I kind of like, you know, look at this. You know, I'm doing this every week. You're paying the grand price of nothing to hear these lovely words coming out of my mouth, and I appreciate it. And I'm forgoing coffee also for you guys. Any day I do these podcasts, I don't drink coffee. With me this week is Dominic Holden, new Stranger news writer and board member of Normal and ringleader in Proposition 75 that affected marijuana laws. Dom, thanks for coming and talking here.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me on. It's good to be here.
And so let's hop right into it. You had a news story that caught my eye about some transplant policy at UW and getting into medical marijuana. So hop right in and describe the news article for us.
Well, what happened, there's a man named Jonathan Simchin. He lives in Fife, Washington. He's 33 years old. When he was 9, he started a huge medical ordeal that involved problems with his kidneys and punctured intestines. And the recovery from this ordeal took years for him. Later, he was diagnosed as a diabetic, and due to complications, the hospital didn't understand, but his kidneys failed. So he needs new kidneys. But when he approached Virginia Mason, they were concerned about his past drug use. So he said, I'm not going to smoke any marijuana, I'm not going to use any drugs, not going to smoke cigarettes or drink alcohol. And so they went ahead and put him on the transplant list. But then when he expressed interest in using medical marijuana to deal with the nausea caused by dialysis, and the marijuana stimulated his appetite so that he could eat to maintain his blood sugar for the diabetes, Virginia Mason said, we're not going to keep you on the transplant list anymore. You need to go to the University of Washington. So he approached the University of Washington, and they said outright, we're not going to give you a kidney either. So, or kidneys. So he doesn't have the kidneys he needs. He needs to go on dialysis 3 times a week. It takes about 15, 20 hours, including transportation. And he's really in a tough place. But unlike some other people who have not been able to get organ transplants from Virginia Mason and the University of Washington, Jonathan Simchin's in a unique position. He can live indefinitely on dialysis, even with his failed kidneys, whereas a lot of other people who have been denied transplants for having used medical marijuana, they've died, sometimes within just a month or so of being denied the transplant. So he believes that if he fights for this and maybe even sues the University of Washington, he might be able to set a precedent for other people who have been denied transplants because of their medical marijuana use.
So this is an interesting story, and it brings up a lot of actual fairly big issues that are kind of going on in medical care right now. One of them that we're just talking about tangentially right now, and then we'll move on to the sort of meat of what you and I should talk about probably today, is this issue about transplant organ availability. Regardless of the organ, whether you're looking for a heart or a kidney or lungs or a liver, the ratio of people who could benefit from a transplant to available organs is somewhere around 1 to 1,000. So, and again, it varies, and this is a very rough estimate, but what that means is that they have to, there's a very extreme rationing system and a very complicated list, and they're really point blank are not enough organs to go around. And partly, you know, there's been a lot of proposed solutions. One that I'm strongly opposed to is that we should start paying people to donate organs. There should be like a bounty, and some of this is sort of on the right, that you should be able to sell your organs, you know, prospectively, or in the case of like an organ that you can recover, like you can donate 2/3 of your liver and survive.
So if your home is being foreclosed on,
you could just sell a chunk of your internal.
Give away one of your
two
kidneys.
Of those lungs, 2 kidneys. I mean, what's the big deal? And you could always go on dialysis if it really got. The other alternative, which has been sort of stymied in recent years, is embryonic stem cell therapy, right? That's the idea. Instead of trying to get a whole new heart, you can make new heart cells using stem cells. And this is my area of research, and I could talk forever and ever and ever on it. We're gonna just dance off of this. So there's a legitimate, this is a real problem. It's a serious problem. And sort of the bizarre thing is, as other medical technologies have gotten better, you get to a sort of an end point. And so most, as you correctly noted, like if you have a bad heart, you can be carried over. Actually, one of the hardest organs to deal with if it's failing is liver. You just need a new liver. There's really no real assist that you can do like it. Sort of likewise with lungs. You can do a little bit. You can do something called ECMO, and there's some ways you can, like a heart-lung machine, you can kind of cover for a little while. Likewise, for if you have a completely failed heart now, they can attach a pump in your abdomen, cut through the diaphragm, and hook it right to the bottom of the heart. And this pump, it uses your heart. Your heart can be not beating at all, and the pump can do all of your heart beating for you. And with long term, you can get into trouble, but you can survive for quite a while waiting for a transplant. We have one of these pumps kind of flinging there. This is an LVAD or left ventricular assist device. And then the final, as you know, is dialysis. It's a little bit of a stretch, actually, to say you can survive indefinitely. You certainly can survive a long time. You end up getting really bad problems with things like calcium and phosphate metabolism, because your kidneys are actually busy running a bunch of other stuff in the show. And Amgen, a local company, one of the drugs they developed, blah, 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 blah. So when it comes down to it, it's a legitimate problem. And you can do these sort of Talmudic discussions about how do you prioritize these lists. And this is exactly what we ram into here, is it fair to deprioritize someone or even refuse outright to list someone because they've admitted past drug use, or if they're thinking about using really a cannabinoid as a medicine. And so we should talk about, you know, so pot, the major active ingredient in pot is cannabis or a THC, and this is actually a chemical made in plants that is actually quite related to a chemical that's made by each of us. So it's like a native part of us. And so in a sense, there's a metaphor here in a very broad, broad, broad sense with opiates, right? We make endogenous opiates, and there's plants that make things that are like opiates that can trigger the same sort of receptors in our brains and in our bodies as it is. And so a classic example, actually, kaopectate, the anti-diarrheal medication, is an opioid. The opiates, right, they can cause euphoria. There are three kinds of receptors. One causes euphoria. The other one blocks pain. And the third one stops up the digestive tract. And this is why your favorite heroin addicts you know in your life are always constipated. And that's pretty much what they do. So the kaopectate only turns on the receptors that involve the gut. And so you can't get high off kaopectate. Please do not make a run on kaopectate. I don't care how much you have. You will never, never, ever, 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 ever get high from it. But it's the same basic chemical family. And just like there's a chemical family with opiate receptors, there's a chemical endogenous chemical family, and there are two major kinds of receptors known for cannabinoids in people. And it's good also to note, this is like as basic of a thing in your body as you can get. What I mean by that is it's been incredibly conserved over evolution. This is critical for making mice and making dogs and making basically anything that's vertebrate has these cannabinoids and has the receptors, and they're basically unchanged all throughout evolution, which means they have to be really, really, really important. And so I babbled on and on and on, and just like I'm kind of implied that like different sort of opiates, different, you know, heroin is different than the native stuff, which is different than kaopectate. The different cannabinoids have different effects. So like, you know, when people smoke pot, you know, this is where I'm going to start. Maybe you like to describe something. I've been babbling on and on and on. Like, what are the typical effects when you're, you know?
Well, but before I answer that, I want to back up just a little bit.
Sure.
And say, you know, all hail science. You're talking about the progress we've made about being able to provide transplants and new organs to people. I think part of the concern when it comes to patients being denied a transplant for medical marijuana is that it is increasingly believed, based on statements from Virginia Mason and from the University of Washington, that the rationale for denying the transplants is not really based on science, that it is more of a moral decision. For instance, in Simpson's case, he was on the transplant list, having not used any drugs or any alcohol, and they really saw him as a candidate. So even though there are very few organs compared to the number of transplant patients, he was qualified. What got him kicked off? Well, it was the marijuana. And there are generally two arguments that we hear about it. The first is that marijuana is so addictive that a person would be unable to stop, even if they thought that their body would reject the organ as a result. And a doctor at the University of Washington, Roger Rothman, he rejects that claim. And he studies the addictive properties of marijuana. at the School of Social Work. And his perspective is, if it's required to keep someone alive, then absolutely, if stopping is required in order to keep someone alive, absolutely they would stop. The same way that a regular pot smoker would stop smoking joints or doing bong hits after work if they really want their job and they know they're going to get urine tested. Mm-hmm. And the second reason that we hear is that marijuana and tobacco can contain a mold called Aspergillus. Mm-hmm. Well, how likely is that mold to actually be on marijuana? It's fairly rare. There's only one case, according to Dr. Greg Carter, another doctor at the University of Washington. And he said, you know, it's very uncommon. Only one case of a patient actually rejecting an organ because of Aspergillus, and they don't know if it's from marijuana. But Aspergillus is present in all sorts of areas in our environment, and it's in the soil.
I was going to say, if you walk outside, you get...
So are patients being rejected because they would walk outside after transplant? No. And it really comes down to an opinion that marijuana users, whether it be for medical purposes or recreational purposes, are just run-of-the-mill drug abusers. And I think that perspective is really dangerous because it's getting in the way of making rational decisions based on good medicine and science.
I can see a lot of the points there, and I should probably add in that, you know, if you go through the literature and looking at the long-term health effects of marijuana, and I mean, the most charitable thing you could say is that it's undemonstrated that there are any serious deleterious long-term health effects. You can maybe drag some things. I mean, if you're smoking, it can be tough in your lungs, but as it's been pointed out many, many times, people do not smoke the volume of joints as they do cigarettes. And even though, you know, the joint might be worse, no study has really been able to demonstrate, to my knowledge, any serious, well-done study to be able to demonstrate long-term health consequences to even pretty heavy abuse.
Well, there was a funny report released recently by funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and they said that there were proteins that would build up in the blood and could lead to, I believe, stroke and heart attack and other conditions, but it required heavy marijuana use. Well, what was heavy marijuana use? It was like 71 to 350 joints a week.
Which is ridiculous.
And 50 joints a day would be required to reach that. And so assuming that you're up for 8 hours... You know, we're talking about nearly 10, a joint every 10 minutes. But I don't think you could stay awake for 8 consecutive hours.
I was going to say, you probably couldn't focus long enough to light a joint after 4 hours.
You have to be smoking more than one joint at a time, which I don't think is possible. But it comes back to the question you asked earlier, which is, how do people respond to marijuana? And some people have a response where it makes them rather spry and excited, and they want to go out and have a chat. Mm-hmm. And other people are, you know, laid flat on the couch, incapable of playing Mario Kart. I happen to be in the latter group, and marijuana makes me really anxious. But what's interesting is that marijuana didn't used to do that to me. It's really a psychedelic. It's not such a predictable drug like, say, speed or cocaine or alcohol, where you sort of know how it's going to affect you. It can affect one person mm-hmm. quite differently from another, and it can affect the same person differently, one experience from the next.
And this makes complete sense because the receptors are everywhere. I mean, what these things are kind of doing, you can think about cannabinoids in the brain as kind of being like the fine-tuning. And depending on how your brain is set up and what else is going on, how your emotional centers in your brain and your memory centers and your activation centers and all those things, it can have a different effect depending on it. It's more like a fine tweaker than necessarily something that's going to push things very far one way or the other. And that's kind of like a lot of psychedelics, where it sort of just sort of twists things a little bit rather than being like a big punch. Like, and this is where a difference from the metaphor I brought up earlier, like opiates, where they're very, very definite mechanism and they're punching at one particular thing and sort of and turning something on or off. And it should also be mentioned, one of the things we talk about, these medical, there's a very legitimate medical use for these drugs. There's not a lot of drugs that beyond pot that act on these pathways. And these pathways are incredibly important for things like how hungry you are. So if you're taking medications, you know, so another thing is particularly earlier on, but even now, like if you're on the anti-HIV medications or you have full actual AIDS, which is much rarer now, or cancer, and you're on chemotherapy, all these things can dramatically reduce your appetite. And as anyone who can tell you looking around, we don't have a lot of good drugs for manipulating appetite, either turning it up or turning it down. And there's no question at all that one of the most powerful drugs that we have that we know of that can tweak how hungry you are or hungry you are is cannabinoids, THC. Or likewise, we have very few good drugs for stopping you from wanting to barf. And this pot is an amazing anti-barfing drug. But it's a serious problem. I mean, you're on other medications. If it's a life-saving medication and but you have to barf all the time, there's few worse feelings than feeling like you always have to puke. And this is one of the few things. So, just to emphasize that people who want to take medical marijuana, it's not, you know, it's sort of taken sort of as a giggly thing in public press, but, you know, these are very serious medical conditions that people are dealing with, and your heart has to go out to them. And there's ongoing research now for sprays, you know, that have the same sort of active ingredients. And it's sort of been funny as they found these receptors, they found other drugs which are work on these same pathways in a little bit different ways that no one even, you know, not from pot, you know, not from any sort of way related to pot as far as where it comes from, but works on the same pathway. And it does not have the same stigma that's associated with THC or some of the other cannabinoids that come from it. Sorry, you want to look like you're going to jump in.
One of the things that's a bit unfortunate is that the government has come back again and again to synthesize THC, the mm-hmm. active ingredient in marijuana, Marinol. And they say, well, we've got Marinol, we don't need medical marijuana. The problem is that Marinol is a pill. And if the problem is that you can't hold any food or water down, the last thing you can do is take a pill.
For sure.
And another problem that a lot of patients have is that they only want to smoke a little bit of marijuana, just enough to get the appetite stimulation without being knocked out cold. And with Marinol, it's either all or nothing.
Yeah.
And anyone who's eaten too many pot brownies and found themselves, you know, clinging to the edge of their bed for dear life knows that the last thing you want if you're trying to overcome nausea is a marijuana overdose, which actually happens. I mean, it's not going to kill you. I mean, you wish it would kill you,
yeah.
and you could just be done with it. But instead, you have to suffer through the whole thing. And if you're really sick, you don't want to have to do that.
And I'm just going to go walk out a little bit on chemistry because I just love this. Because cannabinoids are one of these rare things that's actually a fat-based drug. It's pretty much a lipid.
After chocolate cake, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, no, but I mean, it gets into the fat in your body and it's difficult. You don't pee it out very quickly, unlike alcohol or nicotine. Like, and that's one of the reasons why it's so hard. Like, you know, the effects last so long and it's so hard to deal with it. A lot of people assume that it's kind of like alcohol where you know, the morning after it's all gone and it can stick around for days. And so exactly like these sort of purified forms are trying really hard to come up with more subtle ways of controlling it. But smoking remains just because it's such a quick onset remains still, unfortunately, whatever the problems you want to do it. So that's why the one is like having a spray that you can put under your tongue, which has more or less a similar sort of rapid effect.
And you're the expert on the chemistry. One of the problems, though, even with the spray or any form of synthesized THC, is that you're going to get just one or maybe two of the active chemicals. The effect that you get when you smoke marijuana is a number of different cannabinoids plus another drug called CBD. And depending on the marijuana you get, it's going to have these different drugs in different amounts. Pot smokers will know that, you know, oh, that pot over there, it makes me feel like this, and this other pot makes me feel like that. Sativas are considered to be sort of bright-eyed, energetic feeling drugs. Mm-hmm. And the indicas, you know, are more of the things that leave me unable to play Mario Kart.
And this gets an interesting question because they're only now really starting to figure it out. I mean, it took them a while to figure out what the active ingredient in pot was or active ingredients, and they've continued to find more. And then it's only even more recently they've found the receptors for it. And they have two that are like pretty confident. And as they've dug through the human genome, they found maybe a couple others. And sort of it's a very big, complicated system. And to immediately jump into reduction to be reductionist on it. I think it's a good thing. Personally, I think it's a good thing for the exact reasons. I think, again, like if, you know, to go back to the chaotic pectate metaphor, like if you just want to stop your diarrhea, maybe you don't want to get high. Right. And so, like, it's in that sense, it's a good idea to have it broken down and understand sort of the complexity in the system. We're not there yet. And because of the stigma, it's actually fairly difficult to do the research and sort of try to take it apart and try to figure out what are the active ingredients. In other words, if someone who doesn't want to get high but doesn't want to feel like barfing all the time, you know, the ideal thing is give them something that no matter how much they take doesn't get it. But
and absolutely, that's true. And there shouldn't be a need to, you know, get bombed out of your skull if all you need is some of the pain-relieving properties or the anti-nausea properties. But one of the other aspects of marijuana is that it is psychoactive, mm-hmm. and it can give people a sense of psychological relief from their condition without causing some of the physical harm. And, you know, frankly, what happens to a lot of people is they smoke some marijuana or they eat a marijuana brownie, and the fact that they are in hospice is no longer as traumatizing and difficult an experience. And, you know, I think what a lot of people feel is that if someone is so sick that they're dying or that they are getting no pleasure out of life, give them whatever they want. And, I mean, obviously you're not going to give them a drink because that's so unhealthy that it can really put someone in a bad position. But what it comes down to for a lot of people is we're going to die from a rather miserable degenerative condition. And for many people, the difference at the end of their life between feeling nauseous and horrible and writhing in agony and watching Oprah and eating pudding with their family is whether or not they can smoke marijuana. Now, that's not everyone, but that's a lot of people. And even if it is psychoactive, I think that people have a right to use that towards the end of their life.
I think we have legal psychoactive drugs. I mean, alcohol without a doubt has effects on cognition and many. Admittedly, it's different effects on the brain from some, say, pot. But this is something that's should be pointed out. Based on the data that we have, pot has less severe long term health consequences at high dosages than alcohol does. So alcohol is in a weird world too, where a little bit of alcohol seems to be somewhat beneficial, but there are people who are genetically susceptible to heavy addiction, and just any heavy usage of alcohol has definite, demonstrable, and completely reproducible severe health effects. And anyone who's been in a hospital, you know, who's treated patients or seen anyone who is a chronic alcoholic knows this. Is a very, very serious condition, which has tremendous health consequences. Likewise, smoking cigarettes. Another thing has, you know, nicotine has very broad effects on the brain and the body, and has severe long-term health consequences. Smoking cigarettes, and so, you know, I mean, I'm almost going a little bit further to say, like, if you just think about this as the recreational use of these, the two legal and one illegal substance, and, you know, the evidence, I think, would say that there's no reason to put the one that's illegal aside. It's fairly, I'll be blunt and say, you know, I'm in a job where I can be tested. Pot, because it's fat soluble, is relatively easy to detect over extremely long periods of time. In other words, if you used it a month before, it sort of traces remain in you because it stores in your fat rather than the water part of your body. And you know, but just on the pure health consequences, I would much rather pot to be legal than alcohol. In a sense of what it does to your body long term if you do have problems with it.
Well, I mean, on the good side, it doesn't appear that any of the laws that do make marijuana illegal are stopping people from actually using marijuana.
No, it's that should probably be born that as well. I mean, and this is sort of a surreal world, though. But yeah, I mean, you know better than I from the policy end of it, the legal consequences of being caught dealing or even possessing are kind of ridiculous.
Well, there's 750,000 marijuana arrests in the U.S. every single year, and they've just been ramping up since the 70s.
And so we should now take a moment here to give Dom his appropriate credit for helping make in the city of Seattle pot and possession enforcement the lowest law enforcement priority in the city, whether or not this is worked or this has been followed, but that is the official position, I think, at this point by ballot initiative.
Yeah, we passed that in 2003 with wide majority of support from voters. And now similar laws have been passed in about 10 other cities.
And we've not been...
And San Francisco and Santa Monica and Denver. So it's really catching on. And part of the reason I think it resonates with voters is that because of those 750,000 marijuana arrests, 90% of them are simply for marijuana possession. It's not for dealing. It's not for growing. It's not for trafficking. It's just someone who has a little bit of pot in their pocket. And people don't consider them to be part of the crime problem. Like you say, they're not causing long-term health problems for themselves. They shouldn't be a focus of our law enforcement, and we shouldn't waste our law enforcement resources trying to put them in jail.
Certainly, at least if there are these purported negative consequences, focus on that. And I think the other thing that also comes negative of this is it does, I think, distract from the drugs for which there is very severe health consequences. Opiate like heroin or OxyContin or whether legal or illegal, very severe long-term health consequences. Maybe alcohol. Like again, they say again, alcohol has very. If you're having too much, and too much is not all that much more, not tremendously more than what was typically used. You has very severe health consequences long-term, and so. It's sort of bizarre. This is one of those weird worlds where the science and the public policy sort of really do diverge. And so we come back around to it. And in this context, it is very distressing to have things where you have to go out, you know, anyone who is on a transplant list almost by definition has had some sort of illness and has gone through sort of a miserable experience. And, you know, maybe someday there will be these legal, clinically tested, wonderful drugs that, you know, you don't get high from and totally stop you, treat what you need to treat. And I think one of the things we hadn't touched on so much, another one great one to point out, is neuropathic pain, like a pain that's caused by nerve damage or nerve disease, and diabetes is the most common cause, but amputation and just sort of, there are a bunch of other medical conditions. This sort of pain is incredibly difficult to deal with. And opiate, like, you know, going and taking pain pills. There are not a lot of good pain pills. In fact, so, like, even like something like OxyContin does not work very well at all for this, and it knocks you out. In fact, one of the few drugs that's available was an anti-seizure medication called gabapentin. I think the trade name's Neurontin, but it was, like, meant for something completely else. It was a fairly crappy anti-seizure medication that just worked. They're like, oh, but, you know, like, my feet no longer hurt, you know? And they're like, oh, well, and so now they use it as an off-label usage, and now they come out with a new version and blah, 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 blah. Pot, the active ingredients of pot actually work quite well on this pain. And there are a lot of people who are going to be having this pain looking at the obesity problem. And it would be wonderful to have a medication that treated either barfing or the sort of neuropathic pain or the others that did not make people high. But for now, I think there's a lot of reasons we talked about that, you know, it's medically and scientifically reasonable to say that someone would want to use pot if they need to treat one of these conditions. And it does seem sort of grossly unfair to judge them. And I think, you know, we have multiple overlapping problems. You have this thing where policy has come so detached from the underlying science and is actually somewhat hysterical still. And then you have the other issue that you have a situation where there has to be such a tight selective process that they're always groping for something, any ability to judge it. There are a lot of other things that people get up in arms about how they do the organ transplant, which I think, to my mind, is another idiotic policy decision. It's just to drag feet on stem cell policy and all that other things, try to get as many alternatives to these solid organs as possible to kind of take the pressure off. But
well, I mean, doctors are authorizing the use of medical marijuana the same way that doctors are prescribing the use of OxyContin. And if these hospitals are operating under Washington state law, then they should recognize the authorizations of medical marijuana, and they certainly should not hold it to a, no pun intended, a higher standard than drugs that are more addictive and potentially more damaging, such as OxyContin, which do not get people booted from the lists.
And it's a great point. You know, maybe this is one of the things we should start to finish up on is let's talk about, because one of the big arguments, and I get questions on this on occasion, is whether or not pot is really addictive. You know, there's sort of one camp that says pot isn't really addictive. It's not addictive like, you know, heroin or crack or alcohol. And so I don't know. So I'll let you hop in first and kind of get your opinion on that. You know,
well, I think anyone who, and this is going to be just about everyone who lives in the United States, has known someone who started smoking pot and really got into smoking pot, and then all they were doing was hanging out and being stoned. And really, stoned people aren't very interesting to talk to generally, because they're just so sort of baked and satisfied with the world. And, you know, sometimes what they're talking about is all of the things that they would be doing if they weren't sitting around smoking pot all the time. I mean, those, you know, you want to kick those people in the eyes or grab the joint out of their mouth. So, I mean, clearly it has the potential for abuse, and it can be habit forming. But, you know, eating chocolate cake can be habit forming, and getting fast food can be habit forming, and having even one or two or more glasses of wine after work can be habit forming.
This gets into a great point. I'm just going to jump in, because one of the key things to think about in addiction, and we're going to drift away from certainly particularly my area of expertise, and so maybe we should have a follow-up some point on just on addiction, but with one of the experts who really does know what they're talking about. But there are two broad levels of addiction. There's sort of like the behavioral addiction, habit and getting into it and having it be a response to certain stressors and kind of reaching for it. And then there's like hard actual physical addiction, which is sort of these mechanisms at the level of receptors. So an example of a hard physical addiction would be opiate abuse. If you're shooting up heroin, you actually modify how your body responds to your own endogenous sources of opiates. And that screws up your entire ability to deal with pain. So someone who is a chronic heroin addict and then stops, every cut, scrape, bruise, bump, everything, they feel it. Whereas, like, you know, like, you're not. Like, most of us, like, you knock your elbow, it hurts for a little bit, then it goes away. And that's how endogenous opiates work. They kind of clamp down, let you know, hey, something bad has happened, but at some point, it's sort of ridiculous to keep you in agony. And that part of your brain that's like, it's ridiculous to be in agony is the opiate. Same thing, like, if you had a big accident, and you have the endorphins, which is what's kind of the cocaine and crack sort of fiddle around with. And so drugs that very strongly turn on, step on these sort of pathways that are intrinsic tend to actually have a hard addictive property to them, which is completely aside from, like, you know, at the end of my day and I'm stressed out, I just feel better when I do this. And like you said, that could be like I have a glass of milk, I eat a bit of chocolate cake, I smoke a joint. And so without a doubt, you know, you can say like pot is addictive in the sense of like on a behavioral level. Like all of us know someone every time they get stressed out, they pick up a joint. Like that's how they deal with it. And that's a behavioral addiction. And that does not necessarily mean it's the same thing as having a hard physical addiction to a particular pathway being mangled around with.
I mean, you certainly don't find people selling their cars and their stereos and stealing from their lovers and mothers to pay for their marijuana addiction. I think, while there might be an extreme case, you certainly don't find that in the sheer numbers of people who are willing to, you know, snort their car and house up their nose doing cocaine, which is a highly addictive drug.
Incredibly.
But, you know, one of the problems that we come back to with illicit narcotics is that we're simply not given the information we need to recover from abuse and dependency and addiction on our own. If you look at the way our culture deals with cigarettes or alcohol, I mean, the cigarette warning labels tell you that it's addictive. The alcohol billboards tell you to drink responsibly. Instead, the Office of National Drug Control Policy pays for these ads that say marijuana is all bad all the time, and it's going to lead directly to crack. And so kids maybe try marijuana, and, you know, as teenagers, they find out that these things didn't happen. They didn't become a crack addict. But they never, and they sort of dismiss everything at that point because, it must all be a load of hooey. Or shit, they would probably say. But the truth is that if they do start to use marijuana too much, or they see a friend who's using marijuana too much, they haven't been given this information that, oh, some people can't quit cold turkey like we're told with cigarettes. They need to taper down, or you need to go talk to someone, or here's how you talk to your friend who's drinking too much, or if it looks like they're going to drink and drive, go ahead and take their keys. Have this sort of conversation with that person. We simply don't give Americans the information they need to deal with addiction and abuse on their own. And so a lot of these problems get a lot worse than they would if we would just address this head on.
And be very honest, you know, evidence-based and honest about where we are. So on that cheerful note, go off and research and figure out how to help your, OxyContin snorting friend. But I'd like to thank you, Dom.
Thank you for having me on.
I'd like to thank you for listening. You can check me out. My column is online or in the paper, The Stranger, every other week. If you see the Dominatrix column on the back page, I'm not in that week. I also tend to slog on The Stranger's blog a couple times a week. You can catch me there. I have my own blog, dearscience.org. And I'd like to thank Big Little Dipper Dipper for our theme music. Thank you for downloading.